is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey there, thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today we present an interesting conversation with Professor Graham McQueen. He is a Canadian retired professor and the author of the book called The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. And in our wide-ranging conversation, we discuss the new developments in the investigation of the anthrax attacks of October 2001 and a new lawsuit from a former FBI agent, Richard Lambert, that suggests that when the FBI fingered Dr. Bruce Ivins, that they sat on a lot of information that excluded him as a suspect. And there's more to the story. It's straight ahead here. And today I want to thank the people who, over the last couple of years, have recommended that I interview Dr. Graham McQueen. And I went to my email and just searched for people who had emailed me, and this is some of them. Lauren Howard, Doug Zimmerman in Columbus, Ohio, Del Leonard in Maine, Tom McAfee and Carol Brue here in California, and a number of others who didn't show up in this little search that I did in my email box. I do take requests. And I value the input that comes from listeners who I consider to be part of my podcast community here. So, each of those people I mentioned also is or has been a subscriber to the Peter B. Collins podcast, so I appreciate your support in both ways. And if you're not currently a subscriber, it's never too late. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You follow the link under my picture that says sign up, and there you choose from different options, $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers get a bonus gift from me, an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your input. This is a first. I have never played Anthrax, the speed metal band, as intro music on the Peter B. Collins podcast. But nothing could be more appropriate for today's topic. We're going to talk about anthrax. They're fighting for truth and justice, and I'll take their word for it. This may be the last time I play anthrax as intro music on the podcast, too. Graham McQueen is a professor who is based at McMaster's Center of Peace Studies in Canada and its War and Health Program. He's been involved in developmental work and peace initiatives in war-affected places like Sri Lanka, Croatia, Gaza, and Afghanistan. And he is the author of The 2001 Anthrax Deception. And as I told Professor McQueen before we began the recording here today, more than a dozen of my listeners have emailed me over the last couple of years saying, Peter, you really need to talk to Professor McQueen and get his take on the anthrax attacks of 2001. And there are some interesting new developments that have renewed interest and a little bit of coverage in that subject. So we're going to take that opportunity to talk with Professor McQueen today. Sir, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here, Peter.
And tell me a little bit about your own background and what drew you to an interest in the anthrax episode and your desire to investigate and publish about it.
Well, I'd been involved in peace and conflict studies for a long time at the university. I'd also been an anti-war activist for many years, doing all the things that activists do to try and stop wars, demonstrating, doing civil disobedience, writing articles, doing research. So I took early retirement, actually, from my university when I was just about 55 years old. And in the roughly 11 years since then, I have felt much freer than I did in the university to research and speak out on whatever I want. Mm-hmm. But the general theme is still war and peace. Now, at some point around 2005, I kind of slowly and reluctantly began looking at the 9/11 issue. Mm-hmm. I knew there were people that questioned the official narrative. It seemed a bit far out, but on the other hand, I like to think I have an open mind. So I looked into it, and I found there's just a fascinating repository of material there that does indeed undercut the official story. So most of the last 10 years of my life, from about 2005 till today, have been spent studying various aspects of the 9/11 issue. And that's what got me into the anthrax thing. Mm-hmm. Because I had been hearing little rumblings during my 9/11 research that, you know, this anthrax thing's kind of weird. It happened right after 9/11.
Yeah.
And it was quickly revealed as having come from inside the U.S. military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. Although it was blamed initially on radical Muslims, turned out it had nothing to do with them. And I thought, could that be really true? Because if that's true, that's kind of important. Maybe by studying that case, it will open up other aspects of deception mm-hmm. that we're having trouble unraveling. And I've come to think that that's exactly true. That's why I wrote the book. That's why I like giving interviews, because I think there's a huge edifice of deception that's been built up in the West in recent years. Very, very important, because it's helped launch devastating wars. It's helped restrict civil rights of people at home. And we need to take apart that edifice. And how do we do that? Well, see, I think the anthrax attacks may be a kind of loose brick mm-hmm. in a kind of crucial part of the arch, let's say. Once you take it out, the crumbling starts. And that's why, even though many people today can't even remember what they are, oh, the anthrax attacks, I vaguely remember that. Didn't they find the guy? That's kind of right. The way, I still think, well, no, we can't leave it. Just because other people are trying to sweep it down the memory hole, we need to take it out of the memory hole and say, look at this. Look at what we know about this now. Now, what are the implications of that? So that's how I get there.
Well, I certainly applaud that, because we live in an era where the corporate media has taken the official narrative and basically attempted to cram it down our throats, despite the obvious, obvious discrepancies, contradictions, and downright lies that are, plain for the eye to see. And Dr. McQueen, I spent some time on my own dime in Washington watching the proceedings of the Kane-Hamilton-Zelikow Commission, and it was an inside job. The commission was.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more.
And just this week, I interviewed Senator Bob Graham, who you're certainly well aware of. He chaired the Intelligence Commission Committee at the point of 9/11. He ran the first joint investigation into 9/11. And while he is exceedingly polite and diplomatic and unwilling to be confrontational, he is at the same time doggedly pursuing the release of the infamous 28-page Saudi memo that he hints will show us who paid for the hijackers and their training and their deployment on 9/11. And it's on the one hand, you use the brick metaphor, I'll mangle another one. I'm looking for the thread that we can pull that will cause the, the fabric to unravel.
That's a good one too.
The fabric of the cover-up. And
well, maybe, it, Maybe anthrax is the threat.
It could be. Because it's, you know, on the one hand, encouraging that a guy like Senator Graham continues to press on the issues. On the other hand, you know, he will say that the FBI engages in aggressive deception, but he can't bring himself to call falsehoods lies. Yeah. And he backs into the passive voice and that kind of beltway deference. And so we don't have any elected officials who are willing to full-throatedly demand the truth about these events. And so it's fascinating to me that Richard Lambert, who was a central figure in the investigation of the anthrax events and who was part of the original mistargeting of Stephen Hatfield by the FBI. He was the guy who won an almost $5 million settlement for their false accusations. And I've been a longtime critic of the FBI, going back to the Watergate era when I was a target of COINTELPRO. And I finally got my file released under the Freedom of Information Act in the mid-1980s. And when I talked to Senator Graham about the rogue activities of the FBI that are not, isolated examples after 9/11, this is their longtime zeitgeist. This is how they roll.
That's right.
And yet the apologists and the insiders are unwilling to call that for what it is.
They are. And there's there are a set of very clear taboos here. And you discover them when you step over them. You know, like, I've, as I said, been an anti-war activist for a long time. I annoyed a lot of people. But I never encountered quite the same level of taboo. I suppose the only other equivalent in my lifetime would be criticizing Israel. But this is even worse in a sense. You criticize Israel, you're regarded as evil. When you criticize the official story of 9/11 and go for the FBI and everything, they tell you you're insane. You're evil and insane. You know, you're a conspiracy theorist, you're paranoid, you're just not part of respectable society. And so 9/11 has become an official myth in American civil religion. And I mean it quite seriously. I do believe that nations create religions, and I don't mean it metaphorically either. I mean, I studied religion for years. That's my specialization. And these religions have a whole set of things that you would expect. There's the sacred, there's the profane, there are taboos, there are myths, there are legends. There are times when people put their hands on their heart and pledge to die for this supernatural entity, the state, the nation. And I believe that 9/11 has been rather consciously inserted into that calendar. And what that means is that when we question it, we're soiling a sacred story now. We're outside the bounds. We're doing something that's both intellectually and morally repugnant to people, to many, not to everybody, but to a large part of people. And that a lot of the mainstream media, the politicians, the universities participate in this. My position is, of course, that we have to do just the opposite. We have to look and see how historically important this event was and how symbolically important, and therefore we absolutely cannot leave it alone. We must research it, we must investigate it, we must apply all the standards of rigorous investigation to this event. Mm-hmm. We must not be cowed, we must not be passive or afraid when people call us conspiracy theorists. We must pursue it rigorously. And I believe the same with the anthrax attacks. Now, when you were talking, I'm almost done with this little rant, but when you were talking about Bob Graham, I thought, well, here's a man who he's probably, I mean, I don't know the guy, but he probably has personal integrity, and I doubt if he'd shoot his neighbor or kill his neighbor's dog or anything. He's probably a nice guy. And he wants to know the truth, I suppose, but he knows the boundaries. And he knows that he mustn't cross over certain lines, and he mustn't say what you and I would say, which is, of course the FBI does false actions and blames other people and frames people and at times kills people. Of course they do. This is part of what we learn through history. But you see, if you're a public servant like him, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to say that at most they They make mistakes, they occasionally deceive, but they would never do anything on this scale. Well, our job is to tell it the way we see it.
I appreciate your rant, and I had no need to interrupt it, and we will, for listeners' benefit, get to our topic in a moment, but I can't resist a couple of rejoinders. Number one, it strikes me that in an era of religious extremism, that it's individuals like you, Chris Hedges, and David Ray Griffin, who are believers and theologians, or at least in Hedges' case, studied theology. And your secular activities, I think, reflect, in a very positive way, on your own religious values and spirituality. And I say that as an agnostic. And as someone who deplores the raging religious extremism that is particularly rampant in the United States today. Secondly, Lance DeHaven Smith published a book a few years ago. He's a professor at Florida State, exposing the history of the use of the term conspiracy theory to deride and marginalize those who don't accept an official narrative. And it was introduced, it was a PR marketing campaign, when the American public was resistant to the bizarre conclusions of the Warren Commission regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Right.
And so when you see the history and you see just how useful this pejorative conspiracy theorist, which has been extended now to include tin hat truthers or aluminum foil. I can't remember which the derogative is. But you know, on a certain level, this is just it is humorous bullshit. Yet it is embraced as the consensus narrative by so many people. And as you just pointed out, when you put your foot on that third rail, there's a lot of voltage on it.
There is. And that conspiracy theory term, you know, I used to refuse to discuss it either in interviews or in paper because I just thought it was such a childish attempt to derail rational discussion. But eventually I saw that I had to talk about it, because it's worth its weight in gold for those who oppose us. Mm-hmm. In many cases, they've run out of arguments, they've run out of evidence, but they've got this little club called conspiracy theory, which they continue to whack people with. So we have to talk about it. We have to analyze it.
And I have a movie metaphor for it. If you saw Men in Black or its dreadful sequels, you know, the stars, Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, they had these special glasses that they could use to just cause everyone, you know, within their range to be what, neutralized, or they had a word for it.
Okay.
Maybe it was neuralized or something. But you know, that's what we see, is that you know, our government, aided and abetted by the megaphone of the corporate media, which uses its market research to find the things that scare the shit out of people so that they'll be glued to their flat-screen TVs. It is a vicious cycle that is working very effectively.
It is, unfortunately. So we do the best we can against it, and we run into obstacles. I mean, for example, when I've tried to use Lance's stuff with people, they'll call me a conspiracy theorist. Imagine how you use that. You say, Lance DeHaven Smith has shown that the term conspiracy theorist was really first promoted by the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, they'll say, you're using a conspiracy theory to establish conspiracy theory. So, I mean, he's right, but, you know, we have to continue to find ways to get people to see, I guess, that, you know, just forget about this stupid term and ask about evidence. What's the evidence? What's your theory? Where's your evidence?
Well, and a conspiracy is simply collusion by one or two or more individuals to commit some sort of crime or other misdeed. And so it's become one of those loaded terms that has, you know, largely lost its meaning.
That's right. So in the introduction to my book on the anthrax deception, but the book's title, by the way, is The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. And I knew that using the term conspiracy theory there would you know, lead some people to not read the book. But I thought, you know, we have to challenge this. People are just trying to run away with this term conspiracy. So I do in the introduction exactly what you just did. I said, look, this is what it means. It's what it means in the dictionary. It's what it means in law, because, of course, it's used in law, legal systems all the time. And conspiracies exist. So how do we find evidence that this is or isn't a conspiracy? It's not that difficult. The criteria are already right there.
Well, in the substitute term that Professor DeHaven Smith proposes is state crimes against democracy. And
right.
I just finished reading Peter Dale Scott's latest book, The American Deep State. He blurbed for your book, so I know that you two have some contact. And, you know, he lays out in great detail the lengthy legacy of these state crimes, these government-driven conspiracies. And so it's simply, you know, a diversionary tactic, and as we've acknowledged, a pretty effective one, to try to dismiss things as a conspiracy. So let's talk about those who conspired to,
right,
you know, really fear up the American public, to brush back two top Democratic leaders in the Senate and a couple of media figures in the immediate aftermath of the events of September 11th in 2001. So five people were killed, 17 were sickened by exposure to this. As I recall, the people who died were mostly postal workers. And the investigation, as I mentioned, first falsely, apparently falsely led to Stephen Hatfill, and then when the other theories that had been floated kind of melted away, the FBI seemed to just kind of default to the lone wolf theory, and then they began targeting Dr. Bruce Ivins. And I'd like you to pick it up from there and explain what your research showed about these various phases of the FBI's investigation and the extent to which, as this new pro se lawsuit from Richard Lambert suggests, that the FBI sat on information that clearly would have excluded Bruce Ivins as the culprit in the anthrax attacks.
Right. Well, I'll just begin by saying the Lambert court case is the most recent thing. He just filed it on April 2nd, and it gives us an in to talk about the bigger issue. I like your approach of dealing with it by looking at the phases that the investigation went through. But I'd like to go back to an even earlier phase than the one you mentioned. You began with Stephen Hatfill. But I discovered the more I looked at this that there's a very important pre-Hatfill stage.
All right.
That isn't talked about very much, and that's really where a lot of the intentions of the anthrax conspirators can best be perceived. So a large part of my book deals with that. So let's leave aside foreknowledge for the moment. First of all, anthrax became a big issue before it was supposed to have been publicly known. This is one very fishy thing that you see. In other words, Cipro, which is the antibiotic people started taking after the deaths and sicknesses from anthrax, we can understand how the sales of Cipro started to go through the roof after the anthrax disease became manifest, right, in early October 2001. But what we actually find is that the sale of anthrax started going up dramatically about 2 weeks before that.
You said anthrax, you meant Cipro. I just want to...
Oh, I'm sorry. Cipro. Ciprofloxacin is the antibiotic at the time, which was recommended for anthrax. And if you wanted to make sure you didn't get anthrax, you would take Cipro.
Right.
So yes, thanks for correcting me. About 2 weeks before there was any public indication that anthrax was on the go, and Cipro sales started going up. Now, I just wanted to mention that because I have a whole chapter on foreknowledge in the book indicating that this was not a coincidence, it was not a mistake. This information that anthrax was being circulated clearly came from the perpetrators.
Now, can you define that any further? Was the spike in Cipro prescriptions, say, in a cluster in Washington, D.C., or inside the Beltway, where we can presume people who might have had knowledge would have been located?
I'm pretty sure there was a spike in Washington, but I'm absolutely certain there was a spike in New York City. Mm. And Washington and New York were the two main cities targeted by the anthrax attacks. There were articles in the New York Times before the disease of anthrax became manifest, saying there is a run on Cipro because people are afraid of an anthrax attack. So anyway, I didn't want to get into that one too much right now. But it certainly is an important phase in the investigation, trying to figure out how on earth could that have happened. But then we move into the phase where people are actually getting sick and dying. The first person to die, not the first to get ill, but the first to die was Robert Stevens in Florida. And, you know, from that point on, the real revelation that anthrax is around took place. Now, the crucial period is really October 2001, because Stevens dies in early October, and right toward the end of October, October 26th, George Bush signs the Patriot Act into law. In between there, you have the beginning of the bombing of Afghanistan, and you have the obvious intention that comes forward that the U.S. is going to also attack Iraq. And the anthrax attacks are used both for external purposes and internal. Externally, they are used to support the invasion of Afghanistan because they say Al-Qaeda did it. That was the earliest and strongest theory. Same people who did 9/11 did anthrax. Therefore, we're going after them in Afghanistan. And then the next theory came in right after that, which was that although Al-Qaeda, you know, wrote the letters and sent them, they got the anthrax from guess who? Iraq. So Iraq is the perpetrator. Now, I put these two together, and I call it the double perpetrator in the book. So what that means simply is that you have a state sponsor of the anthrax attacks, which is Iraq, and you have the foot soldiers, the people who actually do the work on the ground, and that's Al-Qaeda. Now, when you think about this double perpetrator, which was a hypothesis very strongly pushed in mid-October, right up to the period when the Patriot Act went through, started to fall apart after that, but for a crucial period, this was a magnificent example of how you implicate the two countries you want to attack and how you get the Patriot Act through Congress, because the anthrax attacks were crucial to that. Mm-hmm. People were traumatized by 9/11, but that was starting to wear off. Mm-hmm. You were getting a lot of opposition growing to the Patriot Act from all sectors, from right to left. And the anthrax attacks were used in the most obvious way by the Department of Justice, who kept haranguing the Democrats, you know, to get this through, hurry up, get this through Congress. Which they did, okay.
Well, and let me pause just to interject that Senator Tom Daschle, who was the Democratic majority leader in the Senate at that time, was one of those targeted, and he very clearly was in dispute with the White House on key elements of the Patriot Act. And so that gives us, an interesting pushback or a motive for targeting him.
Well, yeah, I looked into that, and initially I thought, gee, this doesn't seem to be working out, because Daschle and Leahy, the two senators, right, yeah, Democratic senators who got anthrax letters, both seemed to have been so kind of traumatized by 9/11 like everybody else that they thought, yeah, this is a real present danger, and we will help you. We will work with the White House and Department of Justice to get this through. And I was surprised at how helpful they were in doing all that. But the more closely I looked at it, I realized, ultimately, you're right. There was a crucial moment when these two, and only these two, Leahy and Daschle, they're both mentioned, and they're the only ones mentioned, in an article in the Washington Post that says the Patriot Act hit a snag yesterday. You know, Patrick Leahy, who was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he had a very important role in vetting the Patriot Act. He said, wait a minute, there are compromises we made that you're backtracking on now, and I'm going to slow this down if I have to. And his colleague Daschle, Senate Majority Leader, and remember that the Senate had, the Democrats had a majority of one
right.
in Senate, so they could have actually stopped the Patriot Act. Daschle supported Leahy. It was really interesting to read that article, because there they are. The two of them are mentioned as the obstructors, okay? And so, Ashcroft and Cheney, these people were all worried. They knew that a traumatic event like 9/11 will get people to sacrifice their liberties, but only for a brief time. They will recover, and they were starting to recover.
Mm-hmm.
We need a second blow, And now that the anthrax attacks are upon us, we must use it to get this legislation through. And so the letters to Daschle and Leahy went out within about 2 or 3 days after that crucial meeting where Daschle and Leahy impeded the Patriot Act. Cheney had said, I want this through by, I think it was October 4th. And they, at that meeting, said basically, it's not going to go through by October 4th. Mm-hmm. And then immediately, they both get sent anthrax letters. So actually, the more you look into that case, the more outrageous it appears to be, the more obvious.
And I'll just add this, that over the course of the Bush-Cheney administration, there were a number of points where they created a kind of crisis mentality and used it to jam through different pieces of legislation. And they would do it in front of midterm elections. There were two of those during the Bush administration. And in both cases, they used that to push through bills and sometimes confirmations like Supreme Court appointments that were languishing and that basically, kind of needed that that plunger or that piston to push it through.
Yeah.
And so if you look at this as a tactic, there is a pattern
yes.
that proceeds through the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, where this was kind of a rope-a-dope that was used on more than one occasion.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And anthrax was one of the things they used. So they conjured up all kinds of fear and anxiety. I mean, the newspapers were full of this term, anxiety, fear. They were saying people are on their knees begging for a vaccine. All this fear language was used just before the Patriot Act went through.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that was clearly one of these moments. And then just before the invasion of Iraq, they needed to get people all excited and afraid of Iraq. I mean, there was no objective reason. Iraq hadn't done anything.
Mm-hmm.
Iraq was a state that was already on the ropes. It was going downhill even more. They'd lost half a million children because of the sanctions. They were in terrible shape. So this was a manufactured crisis. And at the crucial moment, Colin Powell comes to the UN Security Council and holds up a little vial and says, this little vial of anthrax, or simulated anthrax, closed down the whole Senate building, in October 2001. And Iraq has all this anthrax. And then he shows a picture of a plane dispersing anthrax, or at least simulated anthrax. And it's beautiful propaganda. I mean, if you admire these public perception events,
yeah.
That's what it is, because he knew perfectly well by then Iraq had nothing to do with the attack on Senate. He also knew or should have known that Iraq destroyed its anthrax repository in 1991,
yeah.
12 years before he's giving this BS. And so, again, let's pull out the anthrax and let's try, at least by association, let's indirectly, to implicate them in what happened in 2001 and what could happen to us in the future. And so you probably know the Center for Public Integrity did this wonderful study in which they counted all the false statements made by 8 top Bush administrative officials over 2 years, from September 11, 2001 to September 11, 2003. They found 935 false statements on just two subjects. One of them was, did Iraq have WMD? And the other was Iraq working with Al-Qaeda?
Mm-hmm.
Just two subjects, 935 false statements. And again, there are peaks. One of the peaks is in March 2003 as they're gearing up to invade Iraq. So yes, there are patterns. Yes, they come out and they create this perception of fear at particularly important political moments.
The other thing I'll add is that the documents that were leaked by WikiLeaks and others show us that the concept of fear as a verb and fear as something that can be produced, accentuated, manipulated is central to the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, the torture regime that was designed and approved by Don Rumsfeld and others in the administration. And so even more recently, I look at the 2014 election period, where the fear was injected via the Ebola scare that was fanned incredibly, exaggerated monstrously by the American media. And this was on the heels of this bomblet that was launched by the Obama team about the Khorasan group, which was supposed to be the deepest, darkest element of the Islamic State or others, you know, who we are supposed to be crouching in fear of at all times. And so, you know, we can see waves of fear injected into the American public conversation at intervals over the past 15 years. It's really a pretty clear pattern.
Yeah, I think it's a very important pattern. And it's not just the U.S. I'm living up here in Canada, and I'm afraid that our government is using the politics of fear also.
Yeah.
As we speak, there is a terrorism case going forward. It's in court in British Columbia, in which two pathetic drug addicts are being accused of being dangerous terrorists who wanted to put off bombs in the legislature of BC. And you don't know whether to laugh or cry when you read the transcripts, because, of course, our equivalent of the FBI, the RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, had over 200 guys or 200 people working on this case to try and bring them along over 4 months to the point where they're completely ineffectual drug addicts lost in fantasy lands, you know, going and playing paintball and stuff, to the point where they could look like serious terrorists. And they bring them along just like the FBI does it all the time. You know, this is a pattern. They know how to do it. Take marginalized, angry people who might have some legitimate beefs. Often they're big mouths, they're dreamers. And you turn them into terrorists. And I don't know, in the U.S. they often get 20, 25 years in prison. I don't know how this one in B.C. is going to go.
Yeah. Now, and just to give you one quick anecdote, and I credit Trevor Aronson, a journalist who is now working over at The Intercept. He was at Al Jazeera America for a while. And he wrote a book called Terror Factory, where he clearly and carefully investigated over 500 of these so-called domestic terrorism cases. And the lowest one that I recall was this troubled teenager in Illinois. And he didn't have any money, he didn't have a car, he didn't have the means or even the mentality to do anything serious. But when he was goaded by his paid informant to, you know, cough up some sort of a plot, he said, well, let's blow up a shopping mall. And so recognizing that he didn't have anything to make that happen with, the FBI agent said, well, look, you know, you've got these stereo speakers here. I know a guy who will trade you plastic explosives for your stereo speakers. Let's go do that.
I know. Do you mind if I give another example?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, because obviously the FBI and the RCMP work together on these things and they share strategies. So this case that's going on in BC right now, the RCMP guy says to this poor hapless drug addict, you know, I want you to work up a terrorism scenario and then I'll help you make it into reality. Do your research. So he comes back and the guy has put together some harebrained scheme about hijacking a train in BC. It just so happens the train hasn't been in operation for years, right? So the RCMP guy bawls him out and tells him to get serious, do his research, and the guy, poor guy starts to cry. RCMP, don't cry, you know, you just got to realize my job is to make whatever is in your head real. That's what I do.
Wow.
And so they give him the money, they give him the C4, they take him to the legislature and show him the bushes, he can put the pressure cooker, but I mean, they do everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we all have to understand this is the corruption of the courts. And I'm appalled that juries are allowing these to be successful. We've got to say, look, this is entrapment of the worst kind. And once we do that, we might be able to start pulling back on some of this, because it shows how fake the whole war on terror is. If you have to manufacture out of such poor material, you know, these things, and Aronson says they were cranking out one of these every 60 days in the U.S.,
yeah,
you know, so it is a factory, and it's just outrageous, and we're both going through this, both countries at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming back to the anthrax events of October 2001, as the FBI appeared to be fumbling along, you know, they ultimately settled on this lone wolf idea. But it seemed to me very risky on their part to finger Bruce Ivins and risk exposure of the American long-term investment and development of chemical and biological warfare products at Fort Detrick, Maryland. And I want to credit Hank Alberelli, H.P. Alberelli Jr., published a book 6 or 7 years ago called A Terrible Mistake. And it is, you know, heavily researched and deeply footnoted. And it takes us through the MK Ultra program that was fairly well known, but many others that were kept quite submerged by the CIA and the military during the development in the 1950s. And what I think the fingering of Ivins risked exposing is that the U.S. continues to actively develop and maintain biological weapons, at the same time, of course, that we deplore and demonize others, including the crude chlorine bottle or barrel bombs that are currently being used in Syria. But we're beyond hypocritical in that posture, and I was always curious about their willingness to make Ivins the fall guy when it could risk further exposure of our programs.
Yes, I don't have good answers to all these questions, of course, but in this case, I think, first of all, that it's very unlikely that the weaponized anthrax that went into these envelopes came from Fort Detrick. That's not the kind of thing they specialized in there. That certainly was not the kind of anthrax that Ivan specialized in. He was working on a vaccine, and he worked with wet anthrax, not dry anthrax. And I have never seen any evidence that he could have done the sophisticated microencapsulation and so on that seems to have been done to these to make it such a deadly product. So what I think they're doing is drawing attention to Fort Detrick in order to not draw attention to Dugway Proving Ground and Battelle Memorial Institute, which are the two places where it more likely came from. And so they really, in their Amerithrax report, the report on the case, the FBI, I think, manages to completely avoid mentioning Battelle. And, you know, that's pretty fishy.
Mm-hmm. And have we learned anything in the ensuing years about the distribution, the delivery of the anthrax letters? The FBI tells us they were mailed from Princeton, New Jersey. Has anything further surfaced about the process in which these letters were mailed and delivered?
Well, not really, as far as I know. The FBI, of course, was determined to finger Ivins for this. And so if you read their final report, there's a great deal of attempt to pretend that science has found evidence that Ivins did it. So they hypothesized that he could have driven to Princeton, and in the amount of time required and the number of times required, he could have been the one to use the supposedly contaminated mailbox. They try to point out to reasons why he might have wanted to go to that area anyway. But the truth is, they can't prove he made the relevant drive. They didn't find any anthrax spores in his car or his house or on his person. So there's no physical evidence, and it's extremely weak circumstantial evidence. They then try to look at the envelopes and say, well, can we tell where the paper in these envelopes was manufactured and the water that was used to seal the, you know, and they try to claim that they can narrow it down. I don't think any of that science has been corroborated or verified. And then they get to, as you know, the actual anthrax, and they claim that they did all kinds of really cutting-edge, sophisticated research, genetic research, which allows them to say that the anthrax spores in the letters came from a flask under Ivan's care, right, in USAMRIT, Fort Detrick. So I don't know of any great breakthroughs since then, and every one of those is weak for various reasons, including that apparently damning thing about tracing the spores to his flask. First of all, that was never a strong case because there were hundreds of people who had access to the anthrax from that flask. So it's impossible for me to imagine how that could have led to a conviction of Ivins in court. But secondly, the National Academy of Science did a study and said, you know, this science is far too experimental to be accepted as definitive. We just don't know if the anthrax in these letters derived from this flask. And then that conclusion was reaffirmed by the Government Accountability Office, which did a study just a few months ago. So the FBI's case was never strong, and it has been crumbling in the past few years through all these other developments.
One of the things that I've never been able to fathom is why a guy like Bruce Ivins, who had access to all of these powerful compounds and chemicals and weaponized materials, would kill himself with an overdose of Tylenol. I've never thought of Tylenol as that toxic, and I've never, of course, tried to kill myself. But does that make sense to you? And you know, are you skeptical that he took his own life?
Well, I'm glad you raised that because very few people do, and even some of my closest friends in what you might call the anthrax dissident community say, "Don't go there, Graham. That's weak. We know he killed himself. Just drop it." Well, I'm not convinced, so I just say he may have killed himself or he may not have. As I recall, the story of his death was first broken by the LA Times, and they called it a suspect death. And I believe it is suspect. I haven't seen anything that would change my mind. There was no autopsy. What's that about? And as you say, you can kill yourself through Tylenol. If you take enough of it, it destroys, I'm trying to remember whether it's your liver or your kidneys, but it's a slow process, and there's a very clear protocol for if you catch someone early enough, you know, within a few hours of them having taken it. I know this because a friend of mine tried to kill themselves with Tylenol. Mm. And, you know, they were worried when they found out, so they took him immediately, or they didn't take him. They told him to drive immediately to the hospital. They pumped his stomach. They watched him, and he was fine. It is an odd way to kill yourself if you're such a sophisticated scientist. And we're all thinking of the death of David Kelly, the scientist in the UK,
right,
who blew the whistle on Tony Blair's government on the danger of Iraq's WMDs. He supposedly killed himself in the woods. But if you've read anything about that, I think it's an astonishingly weak case. Yeah. He was killed, or he was killed by somebody else. So if you read the David Kelly thing and then you turn to Ivan's, I just say, we don't know how he died.
Well,
I don't know.
And one of the sub-themes in Alborelli's A Terrible Mistake is the number of cases where individuals were determined to have committed suicide, who died under very suspicious circumstances. And his real payoff in the book is that he concludes that Dr. Frank Olson was pushed out of that window at the Statler Hilton in New York and did not jump. And he builds a very strong case of some former Nazi types who were recruited by the CIA to help in that episode. And yeah. And so when I hear about these events that end in a suicide of a suspect or a whistleblower, I am immediately skeptical.
Well, you're right to be skeptical, and I think that the recent Lambert court case reinforces that. Not that he talks about this explicitly in the court case, but what he shows is that not only was the FBI's case weak, but they knew it was weak, and there was a very strong possibility that they would have lost if they had gone to court, you know, if they had actually charged Bruce Ivins, which they never got around to doing, and had to go to court. They would have probably lost. Now, if you think about, from the point of view of the FBI, we've got to close this case. We've got to choose a lone wolf, preferably a lone nut. Ivins is our choice. He seems emotionally unstable. We're going to choose him, but damn it, he hasn't died yet. Maybe if we could somehow push him over the edge, then we won't have to go to court. We won't be embarrassed. We won't lose. We can close the case. This is an obvious possibility. And whether they killed him simply by bringing so much pressure on him, that he took his own life, or whether they literally sent some goons in to inject him, I don't know. But perhaps it comes to the same thing in the end.
Well, and false accusations by the CIA, when we look at Hatfield and what he went through, and I can't remember the name of that security guard from the Atlanta Olympics who was falsely accused. And, the treatment of that kid was just outrageous. Yeah. And so, once again, these patterns emerge, and the media rarely connects these obvious events together. And they don't provide the appropriate context for the latest event. And of course, this is extraneous, but I can't resist. You know, we're still trying to understand the event in Florida 2 years ago when Ibrahim Todashev was being interrogated by an FBI guy and two state troopers from Massachusetts, and we're told that he went off on the FBI guy and had to be killed. But the forensic evidence doesn't match the narrative that is offered. The FBI has investigated itself and exonerated this agent, and the case is closed. Florida is not permitted to further investigate it, and so the FBI has very neat ways of mopping up the messes of its own creation. Let me touch on three elements of Lambert's lawsuit. And by the way, it's curious that he's representing himself. I suspect that he either doesn't have the money or couldn't find an attorney.
He is an attorney.
Oh, he is. Okay.
He is. Yeah.
All right. Well, then that elevates his practice. I thought maybe he was doing it as a guy who went to a law library and said, oh, I can handle this. Anyway, he talks about the Washington field office's insistence on staffing the Amerithrax investigation, principally with new agents recently graduated from the FBI Academy. And basically, so he's saying they were lame in intent, and they put very weak people on instead of senior investigators. That's one allegation. He also says the FBI lab's deliberate concealment from the task force of its discovery of human DNA on the anthrax envelope addressed to Senator Leahy and the lab's initial refusal to perform comparison testing. Now, this is a very inside but interesting critique from an investigator who knows how it should be done.
Yeah, Yeah, when you go through that list of things, and that's taken directly from his court filing, you see that he's gone beyond the incompetence theory there. You know, he's willing to talk about mismanagement of the office, but he's also talking about deliberate obstruction of the investigation. He's talking about derailing the investigation by pointing to Ivans, even though there's a wealth of exculpatory evidence, in other words, evidence that would show that Ivans was innocent. He says they're still sitting on such evidence, which neither Congress nor the public knows about. Now, that's really interesting. And basically, they've all along given highly selective accounts of Ivans, of the Ivans case. And they've engaged in perception management. So in other words, what we gather from what he said is not just that the case against Ivans was weak, but that the FBI knew it was weak, and they deliberately went after him, knowing that the case was weak. And that naturally raises the question, which we wanted to raise in that press release, why would they do that? Is it possible they're hiding somebody?
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that they know that there's another direction they could go in, but they're damned if they're going to go in that direction?
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is exactly what I think has happened.
So, Professor, as we wind up here, what would you like to add that we haven't touched on so far that you think remains an open question or an issue that needs to be investigated in order to lead us to the full story of the anthrax episode?
Well, I would like people to pull the anthrax episode out of the memory hole and to look at it. And I'm not here to plug sales for my book, but my book does make an effort. So look it up on Amazon, the 2001 Anthrax Deception. Because what I'm trying to do in that book is to say that the deception that we all know about that led to the invasion of Iraq is part of the same web of deception that was used in the anthrax attacks, and that in turn is part of the same web of deception around the 9/11 attacks. If you can understand the anthrax attacks, you can see that 9/11 is a fraud too, and that's a biggie. That's why I think you really have to look into the anthrax attacks. It could be the thread, to use your metaphor, that will allow the fabric to come undone.
Professor, a real pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Graham McQueen, here on the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Well, that's a real eye-opener. Or would you consider it a poke in the eye? Tell me, Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.